If you want to get your Bibles, we're going to be in 1 Timothy chapter 3 this morning. We welcome the wayward who have been over in Dan's class this quarter. And we won't take time to catch you up or anything, but we have been really moving quickly in this class. We've covered two whole chapters in 2 months, and I think that's quick for us. But the problem is that we only have three classes left today and the next two Sundays, and then a new quarter will be upon us. So we have three Sundays to cover four chapters, whereas we've had 2 months and we've covered two chapters. So you get the idea. It's either the impossible that we're not going to finish the book, which is probably what you're thinking now, that we're never going to finish the book in three classes, or we're going to have to move kind of quickly through these chapters, which is not something that I like to do, but I would like to finish the book. So we're going to get through chapter 3 today. We're going to get into chapter 4 today as much as possible. So I apologize in advance for how quickly that we're going to proceed through this material, but perhaps sometime we can come back and spend a little more time here. The book of 1 Timothy. We have said this quarter that there appears to be two purposes for Paul writing this first letter to Timothy. You have Paul's first purpose mentioned in chapter 1 and verse 3, that he's writing to Timothy that he would go and charge or command some of these men that they teach no other doctrine. So as you read the six chapters of this book, it's very obvious that there is a doctrine, a single doctrine, the doctrine of Christ, that's referred to as the doctrine, the gospel, the faith, various terms throughout the book, some 23 or 24 times, that the singular nature of the doctrine of Christ is emphasized. And so in chapter 1 and verse 3, right at the very beginning of the book, Paul says, Timothy, you need to go and teach these men that they don't teach any other doctrine. So that's emphasized through this book, and we'll see that as we go through these two chapters today. The second purpose is in the chapter we are in today, chapter 3 and verse 15. Where Paul says that he's writing to Timothy that he would know how one ought to conduct himself in the house of God. Now, what is the house of God?
It's the church of the living God.
It's the church of the living God. If you keep reading the verse, Paul's second purpose in writing is, people need to know how to properly conduct themselves in the church. Now, he's not talking about the building. When he talks about the house, he's not talking about the building any more than up in the qualifications that we're going to look at in just a minute. When it talks about the qualification for an elder to be one who rules his own house well. Is that talking about the building? Does that mean he's good with bricks and paint and drywall and sinks and is that a qualification for an elder? You hope not, right? Some of your wives might be more qualified in that area. Anyway, that's not talking about the building. What's that talking about? That a elder, or even it's mentioned for a deacon, that he rule his own house well. What's the word house there talking about? His family. So when you get to chapter 3 and verse 15, he's writing so that Christians would know how to conduct themselves in the house of God. It's not talking about the building. What's he talking about? The family. And so here is terminology that's used to talk about the church of the living God, in the sense of a family and how we ought to behave and conduct ourselves. So that's the second purpose in his writing, and that's used right here in the midst of, we looked in chapter 2 the last couple weeks about the role that women have in the church. We're going to look at the qualifications for elders and deacons just briefly here this morning. He talks about, even you get into chapter 5, how you treat one another, how we treat widows, how we treat our elders, and the like. And so that's how we learn how to behave. Let's start in chapter 3, verse 1. And again, we're going to have to proceed through this more quickly than I want to, but I want us to get the sense of this. This is a faithful saying. Paul says that several times in this book. If a man desires the position of a bishop, he desires a good work. What's a bishop? an overseer. Do you have that as somebody said that? Is that you have that as marginal reading? An overseer? That's the word that's used here. It's the Greek word episkopos, episcopus. It's the idea that you see over, you oversee something. Is that the responsibility of the elders, to be overseers? What are other words that are used for bishops? I've already used one. What are other words that are used for bishops or overseers in the New Testament? Bepops. That's an easy way, I guess, to remember. They have to be pops, by the way. They're supposed to have children. But if you take those six letters in bepops, they're to be bishops. They're to be elders. Depending on what P you put first, they're to be presbyters. They're to be overseers. They're to be pastors. They're to be shepherds. What's the work of an elder? Well, you see it here that he's to be an overseer. When you read 1 Peter chapter 5, the first two verses of 1 Peter chapter 5, you see all three of these words used. And by the way, bepops, six English words, come from three Greek words. And the idea is that they're to be elders. That's an indication of their age and more importantly, their level of maturity. Just because someone is old doesn't mean that they would necessarily qualify. There needs to be a certain level of maturity, and I won't talk any more about that. But anyway, there needs to be elders talking about their age and maturity level. There's the word that talks about overseer or bishop. That's their responsibility. Then there's the word that talks about shepherding and pastoring or feeding. That's their work. That's their job. If anyone, this says, here's a faithful saying. If anyone desires the position of a bishop, he desires a good work. It's interesting. We don't see it in the English, but there's two times you have the English word desires in this verse. And it's interesting that they come from two different Greek words. If anyone reaches forward and wants to be an elder, that's the first desire. They're reaching forward to be a bit. They are wanting to be a bishop. If they desire that, then they are longing. They are desiring fervently for a good work. Well, what's the difference? Is being an elder a position of honor, of esteem, of something that you are, it's kind of working up the corporate ladder and you just get, you just advance and once you reach the elder, you've reached the pinnacle, you've reached the top level. Is that that kind of the description of being a shepherd that's talked about in the New Testament? I've heard yes and I've heard no. Maybe I didn't describe it very well. The role of an elder, of an overseer, of a shepherd, is it a position that's an honorary position, or is it a position of work and labor and toil? Okay. Now, does that mean that we are not to honor our elders?
No.
All right. Is there a difference between being honored and taking a position because it's a position of, if you receive an honorary doctorate, boy, that's a sticky subject these days, isn't it? If you receive an honorary doctorate degree or an honorary, does that mean you necessarily earned it?
No.
Okay. Now, sticky subject, get out of that. Here, and we're only in verse 1, and I said we had to move through. Anyway, if anybody stretches forward to be an elder, the idea is here that they are longing, not for a position of honor, they're longing for the work. They're longing to serve. Someone who wants to be an elder doesn't want to be an elder because they get to rule, they get to be in charge. Someone who wants to be an elder, according to this verse, is someone who wants to serve the Lord and serve the church and to work. A bishop then, what do you have in verse 2? A bishop then, what's your next word?
Must.
What does the word must mean? Is it optional? Are these suggestions, ideas, possibilities? This has got to be. Bishop then must be blameless. Does that mean he's perfect? No. But he's one who is without reproach. He's one who a charge of wrong can't be laid at his feet and held fast. He's blameless. He's the husband of one wife. He's a one-wife man. There's been a lot of discussion about, well, what if What if his first wife died and he's married to his second wife? Can he be an elder? Does he qualify to be an elder? Y'all are saying yes. How many wives does he have? He's got the one. Husband of one wife. I believe that he can serve. And we got to move quickly. Temperate. What does temperate mean? Self-controlled. Moderate. Here's someone who has himself under control. Here's someone who has learned to restrain himself. Who's level-headed. He's temperate. He's sober-minded. He's someone who is sensible, who is of sound mind. He's not given over to those things that would be frivolous in nature, but he's sober-minded. He's of good behavior. What does that mean? That one's tough, right? Can you think of another way to describe somebody who's of good behavior? Does the New American Standard use the word orderly? Respectable? I think there's some translation uses the word orderly or something like that. You got respectable, Gary? Here's a man who lives a life that is respectable, orderly, of good behavior. Does the Bible talk about the life of an elder to be an example to be followed? Yes, it does. He needs to be of good behavior so that others can follow him. He needs to be, or not needs to be, he must be hospitable. Word literally means someone who is friendly to strangers. As you go through these qualifications, you know what we usually do? I think we've got an idea in our minds that we know what the qualifications of an elder and we know what the qualifications of a deacon are. I think we've got in our minds that we don't necessarily have to read this. I think in our minds that the picture of an elder is just an all-around good guy. Is someone who has lived a good life, who's lived an exemplary life, someone who knows the Bible, who loves the church, loves his family, has a wife, he meets that qualification, has children, he meets that qualification. Those are two of the ones that we focus on. And he's just somebody that everybody looks up to. He might be a successful guy in his work, in his business. Is it more than just being an all-around respected person? Is it more than just being someone that people look up to? Is it more than just being somebody who's a pretty good guy? You know, it's interesting that in 1 Timothy 3, and also in Paul's letter to Titus in Titus chapter 1, that God gives qualities that a shepherd must have. Why do you think God took the time to enumerate qualities that a shepherd must have? And do you think he just sort of picked some? Well, you know, we'll take this, throw that one in. Or do you think there's a reason? Why would God take the time? It's the responsibility of the elder to take care of the church. That's what he says in verse 5. Notice the corollary in verse 3 and verse 4. He is to be a man who rules. That's not a word we like, is it? Rules well his own house. What does the word rule mean in the sense of ruling your house? What did you say, Lonnie? Got it under control. Somebody else said something. What does it mean to rule your house? Being the leader. He's in charge in the house. He's the leader. He's setting the direction for that home. He's managing that home. Notice verse 5 says, if he doesn't know how to do that, then he can't take care of the church. Is there a corollary between a man's role in the home and what he does in the home and what he does in the church? Who rules in the home? In an earthly sense, who rules the church? Now, again, we don't like the word, perhaps, because perhaps we live in a society that is rebelling against authority. Surely that's not the case. That we live in a society that's just lashing out against authority. But Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 17 says, obey those who have the rule over you and be submissive. For they watch for your souls. What's the responsibility of elders? Shepherding, watching for souls. And what are they doing? Ruling. Now, does that mean that Christ does not have all authority? Does that mean that Christ is not Lord and King? No. But who's responsible for the church here on earth? The shepherds who are watching for souls, the overseers of the church. Those, verse 5, I saw your hand, Richard, so I'm not ignoring you. Those men who are taking care of the church. So when God determined, I wish we had time to look at Acts 20 and 1 Peter 5, but when God determined that he was going to establish his church, that those saved people on earth would be a part of his church, that there would be local congregations like there is here, that those congregations would need guidance, they would need leadership. He determined that men would be fill those roles, multiple men, plurality of men, not just a single man, by the way, plurality of elders in each congregation. And he said, here are the qualities that they must have in order to be in that position. Was God taking care of his church by putting these things in place? Absolutely. What if there is a man or men who are elders in a congregation who do not have these qualities? Suppose we ignore the one about him being not a novice. Well, he's got everything else, but you know, he's just baptized, but everything else is cool, so we'll just go ahead and appoint him an elder. You know, everything else is great, but you know, his testimony, his reputation, verse 7, among outsiders is pretty lousy. You know, he's not a real great businessman, and there's a lot of people outside in the world who don't have a lot of respect for him, but in the church, he's loved. Let's just go ahead and appoint him. Suppose we just say, well, that one's not really important, but he's got the rest of them. Is that dangerous? Sure it is. Did God want these qualities to be met? He loves his church. He wants those who are ruling over it to be not just all-around good guys, to not just be, well, you know, he's a pretty good guy and he knows the Bible pretty well, but to be those men. Remember verse 1. He who desires, who's stretching out to be this, he is longing for. He is intensely desiring a position of service and work. Okay, Richard, I have no idea what I was saying when you raised your hand, but make your comment and we'll make it fit. No kidding. Subsequent to the raising of your hand, I covered every... Richard and I are on the same wavelength this morning. I don't know if that's scary for me or scary for you, Richard. Okay, back to it. Boy, we're in verse 2 now. Let's see, that's 25 minutes and 2 verses. Yeah. Hospitable, friendly to strangers. Does that mean he has people in his house? Does that mean he's... does this regard how compassionate and friendly he is to people as he meets them? He's able to teach. The old King James says he's apt to teach, to which some people, you know, would make a joke, say, yeah, well, he's not only apt to teach, that guy's apt to do anything. That's not what the word means. He's able, he's skillful, he's knowledgeable to teach and impart and defend the faith. He's not given to wine. He's not, the word literally means he's not even beside it. He's not by it. Wine's not a part of his life. Now, lest we don't have time to get there. Verse 8, when it's talking about the deacons, says that a deacon is not to be given to much wine. So the idea here is that elders are supposed to abstain completely, but it's okay if deacons have a little bit. Is that what this is saying? And what do you mean, not really? Would it be okay for deacons to have a little wine, just not much? Okay, Dave? Okay, when God says that an elder is not to be given to wine, why not? It affects your judgment. Y'all remember the Nazarite vow in Numbers chapter 6? A Nazarite, who was that? Not somebody born in Nazareth. A Nazarite was someone who had consecrated, devoted their life to service to God. In order to fulfill the Nazarite vow, how much wine could you drink? How many grapes could you eat? Or anything like that. Why not? What's the big deal? What harm could a little grape cause for a Nazarite? God, not for a Nazarite, I'm not tying this in directly with the qualifications for an elder, but you go all the way back to the Old Testament. God said not only was the Nazarite to abstain from drinking wine, he was to abstain from anything that even came close. Why? What's the big deal? What does Proverbs chapter 20 and verse 1 say? Wine is a mocker. Wine is a mocker. But deacons, it's okay if you have a little mocker. Just not much mocker, okay? Elders, no mocker for you. But deacons, just not much mocker, okay? Joe, are you, if a deacon could drink a little, Joe says, could he ever be qualified to be an elder? Would he have to change his behavior? Is he allowed to drink a little? You know, you see this term, and I didn't want to spend this much time on this, but you see this terminology. And what happens is, some people want to camp in 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 8 and say, well, if it was okay for the deacons to drink some wine, a little wine, but not much wine, then it's okay for your average bear or Christian to drink a little wine, just not much. At what point does a little wine become much wine? Quickly? Well, Joe, I would expect that your definition of much and your concept of what would be much would probably be different from what mine would be and what Dan's would be and what Pete, because all of a sudden that's very subjective, isn't it? You know, what's much to you might not be much to me. How do you determine that? When the Bible talks about do not be given over to much wickedness, but a little would be okay, right? Just not a lot. And when Peter says that they had their eyes full of adultery, that's bad to have your eyes full of adultery, but you know, just a little bit would be okay, right? You know, just a little, just not full. Would that be okay? As long as it's not. And when James says, put away, what is James chapter 1 and verse 21, I can't remember how that starts, overflow of wickedness, I'm trying to get the first part of it, talks about putting away the overflow of wickedness. You know, here's wickedness, it's just overflowing. Well, just get rid of the overflow and you can keep what's left, right? You know, just stop the overflow and whatever's still there would be all right. The Bible uses terminology where the Bible condemns excess. But if it condemns excess, does it thereby approve of something less than that? Just by automatic? If you talk about overmuch wickedness, overflow of wickedness, eyes full of adultery, would something less than that be okay? If this said, deacons were not to be given to much adultery, what would you think? They're not to be given to much adultery. A little bit, you know, a little bit here and there, that's okay. But much, hey, hold the phone, not much, but a little bit. If the word was adultery here, what would you think? If the word was stealing, the deacon's not to be given to much stealing. Cool, I can still be a deacon and, you know, slick a candy bar in my pocket at the grocery. That's not much. Is this talking about an amount? Or when God condemns the excess here, is he condemning the whole thing? All right, come back to the qualifications for elders. Boy, we're through verse 3 verses now. Not given to wine, verse 3, for an elder. Not violent or a striker, somebody who's ready with a blow. Not greedy for money. Here's what I want you to do as you read these qualifications. Our tendency is to take a man. I'm looking for somebody and I don't want to pick on anybody. Pick a Joe Holland. I pick on Joe. Take a Joe and say, here's a Joe. All right, here's a Joe. Now here's a qualification. Okay, Joe meets all the qualifications. What if you read this passage and you build the man in your mind without thinking of a man? Does this make sense? That you read the passage and you allow in your mind to build the man who is qualified without thinking of any particular man. And once you have that man, that qualified man built, then you take that man and you start looking for him. You're looking for a man who's not given to wine, not violent, not greedy for money, but someone who is gentle, someone who has a compassionate and understanding heart, not quarrelsome. He's not somebody who is argumentative or belligerent or contentious. He's not covetous. He's not somebody who's got a weakness for money, a love for money, but one who rules his own house well. Folks, that's his proving ground. That's his proving ground. A shepherd's first flock is his home. That's his proving ground. One who rules his own house well, having his children in submission with all reverence. For if a man does not know how to rule his own house, how will he take care of the church of God? Direct correlation between what a man does in his home and what he does in the church and the responsibility in both. Not a novice, not immature, not spiritually immature. Lest being puffed up with pride, he fall into the same condemnation as the devil. Moreover, he must have a good testimony among those who are outside, lest he fall into reproach in the snare of the devil. Isn't it interesting? You have all of these qualifications about this man in the church, and then God also includes, and obviously these others would include outside the church as well, but specifically says, this needs to be a reputable man outside the church. He needs to be respected outside the church. God cared enough about his church to set overseers over it, men who would meet these qualifications. Verse 8, likewise deacons. What does the word deacon mean? Servant. Back away from this for just a moment long enough to ask the question, if you're going to have a servant, why does he need to meet qualifications? Why qualifications for a servant? I mean, I understand for an elder, for the leader of the church, for the one who's going to oversee the souls and the work of the church. I can understand, but for somebody who's going to serve, be the servant in the church, why qualifications for him? Wouldn't just anybody be okay to be a servant? Lonnie? At certain times, he will be representing the church. Is that true? At all times, a deacon says, he will be representing the church. Would it be important that he meet certain qualifications? More than just being an all-around good guy. More than just being, you know, a guy who's good with a shovel. Or, you know, somebody who's good at climbing ladders and changing light bulbs. It would be better to meet. It's interesting to me that when God placed special servants in his church, that even them, he said, you know what? They need to meet these qualifications because they do represent the church. How often in this assembly do we pray for our deacons? Probably once a week would be my guess. That deacons, not mentioned all 21 of them by name or however many there are, but we pray for our... Why do we pray for them? Because they're serving a special role in the church. Here's their qualifications. Likewise, deacons. The word must be is in italics here. It's not in the original. So some have said, well, maybe they're, you know, maybe this is just, maybe these are optional, but the word likewise says this is not optional. Likewise, they must meet these qualifications. They must be reverent, dignified men, not double-tongued. They don't say one thing and then do another. Or they don't say one thing to one person and then say another thing to another person. They're not double-tongued. They're not given much wine. We've talked about that. Not greedy for money. What's all this talk about money? You had it for the elders. Here's deacons. They're not to be greedy, shamelessly fond of money. Even elders were not to be greedy, have an unhealthy desire for money. What's wrong? Why would that be a big deal? Do the elders and deacons handle the money in the church? Sure they do. Not greedy for money. Verse 9. A deacon must be one, present tense, who's holding the mystery of the faith with a pure conscience. He must be one who has a steadfast adherence, holding on present continually to the mystery of the faith. Not just any faith, not just any belief, not just any doctrine. Well, here's an elder who's going to be able to teach and guide and lead the congregation. Here's a deacon. All he's some people's terminology and mentality. All he's going to be doing is serving. What does it matter if he's holding to the faith? Okay, it matters because it's a qualification the Lord has established. It matters because, as one deacon says, at all times he's going to be representing the church. Is it possible that our deacons will do any teaching? That our deacons will do any teaching in classes or in personal Bible studies? Is it possible that any members would go to deacons with Bible questions? Here are men who represent the church in some way. And God says, these men need to hold the mystery of the faith with a pure conscience. But let them also, so not only the deacons, but the elders must be tested, but let the deacons also first be tested. They need to prove themselves. Then let them serve as deacons, being found blameless, same word that's used for elders, one who's without reproach. Likewise, verse 11, their wives. Can you believe it gives qualifications for the wives? Why would it give qualifications for the wives? I mean, as long as the men have got things right, is it possible that their wives could cause them to not be qualified to serve? Yeah. Likewise, their wives must be reverent. Same word used for deacons in verse 8. Not slanderers. What does the word slanderer mean? You got any marginal notes?
Gossip.
Not malicious gossips. They need to guard their tongue. They must be temperate. Same word used for elders. They must be faithful, trustworthy in all things. Let deacons be the husbands of one wife. Same thing about the elder. Ruling, he's the leader, he's the one standing in front of his children and their own house as well. Isn't it interesting that the greater responsibility, the greater the public service that a person has in the church, the greater the degree of responsibility that they have? Go back to chapter 2 and verse 8 for just a second. I desire therefore that the men who lead prayers, the men pray everywhere, these men who lead prayers, what was the qualification for those who lead in worship? That they have holy hands without wrath and doubting. Is there a qualification for men who lead in worship? What about men who would serve as deacons? What about men who would serve as elders? The greater the degree of public service in the church, the greater the degree of responsibility. Why does God care? Because God cares about our souls. He wants souls to be saved. Verse 13, for those who have served well as deacons, obtain for themselves a good standing, they're trustworthy in their service, perhaps for more service, and great boldness in the faith which is in Christ Jesus. These things I write to you, though I hope to come to you shortly. But if I am delayed, I write so that you may know how one ought to conduct himself in the house, in the family of God, which is the church of the living God. What is the family of God? The church. If I went looking for God's family, where would I find it? In the church. Is it possible I'd find any family members outside the church? If I was looking for God's family, where am I going to find them? I'm going to find them in the church of the living God. The church is a pillar and ground of the truth. We have been entrusted with the truth as the church. We are the support, the pillar, the foundation of that truth. We have a responsibility to teach it. Verse 16, and without controversy. This is beyond dispute. Great is the mystery of godliness. Notice this beautiful picture. Six points about the life of Jesus. He was manifested in the flesh. Remember John chapter 1 and verse 14? The Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld His glory as the only begotten of the Father. He was manifested in the flesh. He was justified in the Spirit. Christ was vindicated. He was proven to be right in His life. He was seen by angels. When you think about the life of Jesus, does it ever talk about angels ministering to Him or angels being with Him? At his birth, were there angels? At his temptation, were there angels? When he's in Gethsemane, were there angels? At his resurrection, were there angels? At his ascension, were there angels? They're all over the place. Preached among the Gentiles. Anybody have a different word than the word Gentiles in your translation? Preached among the nations. Was Jesus preached only to the Jews? No. The gospel is universal. It's preached to everyone. It was believed on in the world. You read the book of Acts, and the gospel spread throughout all of that region. And then you even come into Colossians chapter 1 and verse 23. How far did the gospel reach? Paul says, the gospel has been preached to every creature under heaven. Colossians 1 verse 23. He was believed on in the world. He was received up in glory, talking about his ascension. Beautiful picture of Christ, this mystery of godliness. Why does it call it a mystery? The same word was up in verse 9 to talk about the mystery. Why is it calling it a mystery of the faith? Why does it call it the mystery of godliness? I got 30 seconds. You got the end? Oh, I got a minute and 30 seconds. Good. Say again. Well, mystery is a hidden truth, something that has been kept back or hidden for a certain period of time. Okay, read Ephesians chapter 2 and Ephesians chapter 3, and you'll see probably clearer there than anywhere else that the mystery, were the Jews expecting the Christ? They had a hard time connecting Jesus of Nazareth with the Christ. They were expecting the Christ. They were expecting the Messiah to come. They were expecting the kingdom to come. But for some reason, the Jews thought it was just for them. But part of the mystery of the gospel, mystery of the faith, was that this was for everyone. But you know, the Jews should have got it. Isaiah chapter 2, we don't have time to look at it, but read the first two verses of Isaiah chapter 2, where it talks about that all nations, when it reached the kingdom, it says all nations would flow unto it. How many nations? Everybody. Jews, Gentiles, everybody. The gospel was preached. Why? 1 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 4. God desires all men to be saved. Is that Jews? Is that Gentiles? Is that man, woman, slaves, free, Gator fans? Need a lot of grace there for some Gator fans, right? Carol, you got your hand up. Sorry, Pete. God cares about His church. Think about this. 20 seconds. Think about this. When God says in Acts 20 and verse 28, the church which Christ purchased with His own blood, He was talking about the church that Jesus purchased with His own blood. Who was Paul saying that to in Acts chapter 20? Elders. He was talking to elders in the church about Christ purchasing the church and how they needed to guard that church and care for it. All right, we gotta quit. We got one chapter done. We'll pick up in chapter 4 next week.